food is chemistry. That's why, despite the evidence of some of your senses, or perhaps just your common sense, a combination of, say, a banana with foie gras and passion fruit on a bed of chicken skin might perhaps be quite delicious. Ditto an almond biscuit with broccoli and clams. To explain the mysteries of food pairing and how this culinary science works, Bernard Lahousse is science director at Food Pairing and co-author of The Art and Science of Food Pairing. Bernard, welcome.
Thank you, Jonathan.
From where did you get this, to begin, the interest in this rather arcane science?
Well, I had a grandmother and a mother who really are passionate about cooking. So my grandmother cooked almost every weekend for the whole family. And they also took us every year to Michelin star restaurants. So I really got the love for food through my mom and my grandmother. But I'm also really passionate about food chemistry. So when I need to decide what I'm going to study, I choose a bioengineer because I wanted to know much more about food and about the chemistry. And then one moment, I think about 15 years ago, with the whole molecular gastronomy, chefs also became interested to work much more with the chemistry. So there I started to collaborate with a number of chefs.
I mean, it is an extraordinary thing that we all eat. We all have a relationship with food. And yet not many of us would consider those things on the plates, the way we respond to them is chemical, the way that those ingredients react with each other is chemical, that there's a lot of science going on.
Yeah, indeed, chemistry and physics. And if you understand the chemistry behind the food, it also allows you to be a better chef. If you understand the Maillard reaction and you know that there are two parts that you need to bring together, you can actually tune that to improve or adapt the taste of the dish as you wish.
The beginning here is, of course, taste. Tell us how that works.
Well, if you look at our eating experience, so flavor, it's a combination of taste, which is with your tongue, smell, which is with your nose, and then texture, which is also taking place into your mouth. So if you look at the importance of the three components, we often think that taste is the most important because we put food in our mouth and then we taste. But actually, taste is just five or a bit more basic taste, while with the nose, you can smell almost an endless amount of different aroma molecules. And in this COVID times, if people lose the sense of smell, well, they say they almost don't taste anything. Food becomes really bland. If you have a cold and your nose is blocked, you don't taste anything. It's because that aroma space of a smell is so important in the food experience. So it's not the taste which is most important, it's actually your nose which is the most important.
What's the nature of those aroma molecules? And I guess the point is here that they are held in common in various types of food. Is that how the sort of complementariness of it works?
So aroma are volatile, so they need to be capable to reach your nose. For example, in our database, we have more than 9,000 different aroma molecules.
Wow.
With all different description of how they smell. And when you look at food pairing, it's really a methodology that takes into account those volatiles. While originally, when Heston Blumenthal and François Benzi started with flavor pairing, they found out that aromas in common are the ones that make food work. But when you dive deeper into the chemistry behind, we find it's, of course, much more complex. It's indeed about similar molecules, but also the other molecules in your food also have an influence. The type of food the aroma is in also have an influence. So it's much more complex, but in essence, it's finding aromas in common between different food products.
Can we group those aromas in like a color wheel, for example?
Yes, that's a work we've done. So with taste, we know we have five basic tastes. What we do with the 9,000 different aroma molecules, because for each of those aroma molecules, we have a description, you're actually capable to cluster that into a number of big clusters. So for example, there's a group of aromas which are called esters. And when you smell them, they have in common that they almost all of them smell fruity. but the one will smell a bit more like pineapple, the other one a bit more like berries. So through the clustering of the chemistry, we found out that there is a big group of fruity molecules, but there are also roasted, floral, cheesy, spicy, green molecules. So we could detect about 14 clusters to describe the whole aroma space.
Are we able to, I mean, apart from making pairings based on that sort of aroma, that molecular science, are we able to also play with that, to alter the sort of aroma molecules that attach to particular foods?
Yeah, that is possible. Of course, we always try to work with the nature as such.
Of course.
So it can be through fermentation. Why is a wine sometimes smelling like a tropical fruit? Not because you add a tropical fruit, but because there's a fermentation where those fruity esters are made. So fermentation already gives you a really big toolbox to actually alter the flavor and maybe make them more fruity, or reduce the floral notes, or reduce the green notes. The same with, of course, baking allows you to increase the number of roasted, maybe nutty notes. So actually cooking is already playing with those aroma molecules and trying to increase some of them and decrease some other ones.
How much of this, though, depends on memory, depends on our psychological response to that molecule which I associate with this particular scent and taste?
Well, of course, the big advantage of a tool like food pairing is that it really opens the possibilities. A chef often is really good in combining the ingredients that he can find in his place. So he knows if he is at the sea, he can work with fish and with scallops, and he has some vegetables from the land. But the nice thing about food pairing is that we go over borders. So maybe the best food from an Aboriginal could be combined with tropical fruit from Peru. So the algorithms really don't look at boundaries, because chefs cook with the ingredients they have. But maybe the best combination for you is something that you never could find out, or unless you were very lucky.
So the algorithms that you've developed, they're a way of making suggestion, I suppose, of perhaps offering a surprising possibility.
Yes, absolutely. We see that in restaurants, but also into retail. Consumers are really looking for new, exciting experiences. And making a surprising combination is definitely one of them. If you look how snacks and drinks evolve, people are really looking for something new.
Tell us about benzaldehyde and how that is used by chefs.
Well, benzaldehyde is a molecule. If you smell it, it smells like almond marzipan or an almond cookie. Mm-hmm. So if you buy, for example, an almond extract, and you smell that, definitely benzaldehyde will be present. So it can be used to increase the almond notes of a dish. But benzaldehyde, for example, it's there in a whole family of plants. So not only in almond, but also in apple, cherry, but also in the wood, in the leaves. So if you would use sakura, then it also contains benzaldehyde. But benzaldehyde, I can also make starting from amino acids. So it can also pop up in ham, in chocolate. So all these ingredients, they all contain benzaldehyde. So if you see that, then you know, okay, chocolate and almond, I can combine right. Chocolate with cherry. Or I can do ham with chocolate or cherry with ham. So it really opens the possibilities.
Is there a point, though, that despite the fact that scientifically chocolate will pair with oysters, that another part of our mind may not accept that possibility, despite sort of the, yes, that is going to work, but I'm still not going to put it in my mouth?
Sure. And for example, we have chefs, when they first apply food pairing, they start like in the appetizers, because people are much more open in appetizers.
Of course.
Another one is we have a baker. And that baker is organizing each month a kind of a tasting session, because he really goes wild and you really need to educate the people. So it's true that if you are completely new into the field and you get an extreme combination you don't expect, that it will maybe put you off. Not if you get it blind, but if you see it, it could put you off. So it was really also a task for the chefs to educate consumers and really open their mind in what possible combinations there are. And it's also cultural dependent, because I can say chocolate and chicken, maybe it's weird, but that's Mexican. I can say chocolate and eggplant, maybe it's weird, but it's actually a classic Italian dish. So it also depends on your context.
Yes, indeed. Is this knowledge exhausted yet? Are we still discovering these flavors, still discovering molecules that contribute to taste?
No, we're still discovering aromas, and I think there's still a huge space of aromas that are still need to be discovered. With our nose, we can detect an endless amount of molecules, but if you look at which are the molecules that in food we often use, you can almost reduce them to 200. Hmm. So we evolve with the food, and it's a group of aromas that often appears, but while we are analyzing new fruits from the Amazon or new insects or seaweeds, we find each time about 10% molecules which are not known yet. So there's still a lot of work to do.
You just mentioned insects. Now, this is an interesting branch of your work. Tell us more about that.
Well, actually, the work with insects started about 10 years ago with Alex Atala. So that's a chef from Dome in Sao Paulo in Brazil, because he went into the Amazon and talked to the indigenous people, and they consume insects like ants. So he started to work with that. And some of the ants really tasted great. So there is one ant that tastes like lemongrass ginger. And if you analyze the ant, you indeed see the same molecules as in lemon and in ginger popping up. For the ant, it's to protect him from bacteria. But the surplus is that the ant actually tastes like ginger and lemongrass. But we know that our food system is broken, so we need to eat in a different way.
Yes.
So we see also many startups popping up. So we also analyze mealworm, crickets, a whole number of insects, really to help out those companies and consumers to integrate the food into their new diet.
You've mentioned wine already, and we're very used to this idea of trying to analyze, to parse the aroma of wine in ever diminishing circles of descriptive adjectives. But the worlds of beer and coffee are also areas in which you're showing an interest.
Yes, indeed. Being based in Belgium, we should have beers, of course.
Of course.
So we have about 2,000 different beers analyzed. Same for coffee. For example, we visit different regions in Colombia to analyze the coffee. And it's really remarkable to see that although it's all Arabica coffee, that the height or the amount of rain that the coffee receives really has a big influence on the final profile of the coffee. So having those profiles, it also allows us then to see how can coffee be combined with what food, or what beer fits well with which dish?
Give me a surprising beer and beer snack combination, Bernard.
For example, we have a beer in Belgium, a Deus, which is almost like a champagne beer. Mm-hmm. And that, for example, can be combined with a combination of oyster, lychee and rose.
Expect to see that on a bar table near you soon. Bernard, it is extraordinary branch of culinary science, and it is wonderful that we can apply so much certainty and your algorithm to this notion of food pairing. Thank you so much for walking us through.
Thank you.
Bernard Lahousse, Science Director at Food Pairing. He's the co-author of The Art and Science of Food Pairing. This is Blueprint, Radio National.